Hello, welcome to the Right Podcast. I probably don't need to tell you that on January 3rd, Nicolas Maduro was seized by U.S. forces in a major military strike and taken to the United States to face federal charges. It's an unprecedented direct intervention in Venezuelan sovereignty with many consequences and repercussions yet to unfold. But in that discussion, there's an underlying and then some layers of an onion, to be peeled back. One of those is that what we might not realize when we're talking about what happened or the debate about Venezuela is that a component of this is over international order. And I say that with some caveats and things because this shouldn't be geopolitics or international order or theory. It should really be focused on the voices of the people that are organizing and struggling in Venezuela now and who have been. That's not going to be the case, but I'll talk about that a little bit later. What's changing is not simply who holds power, regime change, but what power is expected to answer to. And by that I mean power, global power, is becoming less grounded, even if in theatrics. It's becoming less grounded in law, consent, universal concepts, universal norms, things that were meant to codify action, again, whether or not they were manipulated and actions occurred as they had previously in other world orders or not. But that what's emerging is power and leverage in and of itself. That's the justification, is that it can. And appeals to accountability, and these come from many different spaces, or to some type of universal ethic or moral, are mostly dismissed as naive or irrelevant at this point. And I think most people, understand that, but it's something that I don't hear many people pointing out in these conversations, right? There's geopolitics and there's international relations, but there is a change, and I think that people, especially on the left, aren't talking about it much because of the skepticism based in what was supposed to happen, meaning actually following some type of international order, and that was really just a cloaking mechanism for the United States and the West to do what they wanted anyway. But I think it's worth looking at because things are changing. And in doing so, I wanted to also kind of point this out at the top too, because structurally, and we have to accept some things here, and there's always qualifiers and caveats, but structurally, under a unipolar neoliberal world, right? Under unipolar neoliberal conditions, the collapse of internationalist infrastructures reorganized, and this has happened over a long period of time, and it's not just one thing, but organized into anti-hegemonic politics based more around concepts of sovereignty than of universals. And narrowing the space for universals, things like class, race, and gender-based solidarities, rendered both left and right rejections of, more broadly, we could say, maybe universality, right? The concept or the result of common structural conditions. But this happened with a surprising convergence of left and right. And what I mean by all that is that it's important because I often fall into positions in the opposition to individuals and figures and people or groups or even ideas that are identified. People use the self-identification sometimes, especially public intellectuals and media, including alternative media. And it's hard not to, with their large audiences and contrarian controversial takes that can't help but make you feel that these people are somehow compromised or biased or something isn't right. It makes you want to prove them wrong, and that's okay, and that's fine, and I think there's room for that accountability. But the observations that I'm talking about are bigger than individuals, and really focus more on structural conditions influencing existing ideas rather than exceptional ideological shifts, you know, or trying to call someone or something out, at least in what I'm going to be talking about in this podcast today. I guess another way of saying it is that it's more about larger historical observations or even, you know, sociological outcomes than criticizing groups and individuals. And that's why I think it's worth saying that the structural approach is focusing on the common conditions under which both we're going to see left and right positions have converged in some ways. So that might sound abstract with caveats and follow-up questions, but that doesn't mean that it is per se. It's just focusing on a different thing. And I'm sure a close listener can connect the dots to public figures or positions that apply. So that's a lot. And, you know, where do you begin with something like that? Well, there's lots of places, but when I was thinking about it, I was thinking about Donald Trump's remarks to Ukrainian President Zelensky. Specifically when he said, paraphrasing, that Zelensky didn't have the cards. You know, Zelensky didn't hold the cards. He wasn't in a position to be making demands. And, you know, at the time, I think that was taken a few different ways. But in retrospect, I think it captured a shift with some unusual bluntness and clarity. I think it described a worldview defined by power, who can implement it and who can survive that form of escalation. So it's redefining how we're interacting with each other in a very blunt way. It's describing power in a way that's different, meaning who can wield it and who can survive escalation from doing so. Now, again, I think many people would argue, well, okay, it's always been that way, and that's true. But I think that the change is more than just window dressing, and that there are implications involved. And of course, the implications, one of them being that in this situation, where a worldview is defined by power and who can implement it and who can survive, you know, the consequences of doing so, makes sovereignty conditional. This pertains to a country, so, you know, Ukraine or Venezuela, to its leader, but also to those who make up the country. So individuals' sovereignty becomes conditional as well. And the voices the voices that most don't want to talk about, right? The voices on the ground, voices in Venezuela of labor organizers and people that have fought on many different fronts in many different ways. We're going to continue to struggle. So this depiction of power is limiting, and it decides in advance where politics is allowed to exist. But it's not conclusive. And those voices that I just mentioned do still exist, and that's important. This logic operates well beyond Trump, and it stretches and structures debates about Venezuela, Ukraine, Syria, but more broadly, global order. It shapes both left and right-wing perspectives. The right maybe by appealing to strength, and the left maybe through anti-hegemonic arguments. But while these things appear opposed in the broader conversation that maybe generates from an event like what happened in Venezuela, they seem to be different, but they converge on some things. And one of the things that they converge on is an assumption that states in power determine political relevance, and that those are the things that should be focused on. And I know that for many listening, they're going to hear that and say, well, yeah, you know, those are tankies, or those are campists, or phrases like that. And, you know, yeah, there is some of that. But there are other dynamics involved as well. So Trump's remark about the cards, it operated as a diagnostic lens rather than just being provocative. I'm sure he had no intention of that happening, but that's what it turned into. And it really clarified why, at that time, Ukraine's fate was framed as a function of how useful or disruptive it was to stronger actors, rather than as a question of its own political will, or more importantly, the will of the people who live there. And the logic, again, implied that autonomy was conditional, not intrinsic. And the same logic is at work in Venezuela, right? Even if it's articulated through a different set of justifications, and there are different justifications and histories and precedents for Venezuela. So many of you have probably seen the reappearance of the Monroe Doctrine in public discourse, right? That's one example. The idea that the Americas in general are a space where the U.S. has special authority, very similar to how Russia depicted Ukraine and more broadly former Soviet territories before its invasion and occupation, or maybe how China describes Taiwan as well. But interestingly, you know, tied to this is, you know, it's something that Noam Chomsky said that I thought of. And it kind of echoed this by restating an international realist question of what would happen if Russia set up a base in Mexico. And this was supposed to talk about Ukraine's aspirations for independence from Russia, or even ascendance into NATO. And, you know, it was supposed to ask, well, what would the U.S. do to make Russia's actions, if not ethically or morally, you know, correct in an international realist perspective, seem sensible? And the question is less important, I think, because I kind of disagree in the premise, but the question is less important than the underlying logic that drives the response. And that logic being spheres of influence. So more on that in a moment. The clearest legal argument comes from, for what happened in Venezuela, comes from Manuel Noriega. In 1989, the U.S. invaded Panama, captured the leader, and transferred him to the U.S. to stand trial for drug trafficking. Court arguments invoked the Kerr-Frisbee doctrine that stated how the defendant is brought to the court is not relevant to the court's jurisdiction once they're there, meaning doesn't matter if the person is abducted or otherwise seized in violation of international law, that the trial itself can still proceed once the defendant is in U.S. custody under U.S. law. And Noriega's defense argued that he was entitled to head of state immunity. Interestingly, the type that the Supreme Court recently gave to President Trump. That's another discussion. But that, anyway, Noriega had head of state immunity, and that he had been captured through an unlawful invasion, and that the whole trial was impermissible. It was an extension of U.S. criminal law into what should be international politics. The U.S. courts rejected these claims. It ruled that Noriega was not a legitimate head of state, and because of that, violations of international law and his capture did not bar domestic prosecution. It's going to basically be the same argument that is attempted to be made against Maduro if things don't change, if there actually is a domestic trial. at the time, this out, even for those who supported it, this outcome was framed as exceptional. And it was seen as a response to a uniquely criminal figure operating in a uniquely different style of narco state. And in retrospect, it seems less like an anomaly and more like a prototype. It established a model in which military force could generate its own legal jurisdiction. Domestic criminal law could legitimize geopolitical intervention, and violations of international norms could be rendered legally irrelevant after the fact, like post hoc. And that's all interesting, but there's another historical piece to this that I find equally, if not more interesting, and that's the idea that the KSAT at the end of Cold War rhetoric, based around spheres of influence that I mentioned before, you know, the hidden kind of insinuation in that Chomsky observation that, you know, we're just acknowledging these things. So the Noriega trial is interesting because it sat at the end of that kind of Cold War rhetoric and spheres of influence, framing external control as national security management rather than jurisdictional authority. In the Noriega case, Cold War security rhetoric didn't go away, but it shifted from anti-communism to narco-terrorism. And that shift, I think, is very important. You know, but this trial was in 1989, and the Soviet Union was on its last legs at that point, right? Anti-communism was no longer a justification for power, at least not in the way that it previously was. So a shift to narco-terrorism made sense in the spheres of influence paradigm because it allowed for power to continue within those existing parameters, even though the engine for that, the anti-communism, wasn't as much of or perceived as much of a threat. The spheres of influence, Panama, were still intact regardless. It's just that anti-communism was fading, so narco-terrorism took its place. Those parameters changed with a post-Soviet world, and narco-terrorism isn't a global threat. And so like anti-communism, narco-terrorism kind of lost its influence, right? It's not a reason to invade a country on the other side of the world, especially if it was in a former sphere of influence of another power. But as Chomsky and others argued, in their eyes, bad faith humanitarianism or new humanism took that place of anti-communism, or maybe even that momentary narco-terrorism, where we are in between spheres of influence and Cold War views and neoliberal globalization. And of course, then Islamic terrorism after that. So during that timeline of supposed rules-based international order, justification, or its facade, right, became less important to domestically as Republicans and Democrats split on issues of world order and what the U.S. should be in that context. Going back in time, Democrats favored jurisdiction. Jurisdiction generated by managed legal international architectures, including mechanisms like extradition treaties, sanctions, international financial pressures, IMF, ICC-style legalization, essentially rule of law language, right? Codified language and human rights as conditionality. Republicans frame this as the opposite for the United States, as weakening America, as a loss of sovereignty, perhaps, you know, represented as one of the first ruptures in this in George W. Bush's preemptive strike argument, or coalitions built outside of international organizations. So fast forward again to what's happening now, and Trump is attempting to usher in a new era, and I say new because there's lots of old in it, but a new era that returns to spheres of influence without that those Cold War era justifications. Narco-terrorism, once again, is proving useful in serving that role, reviving arguments familiar from the Noriega era. It also serves a new purpose by leveraging the post-9/11 Department of Homeland Security architecture for domestic control, including the use of ICE. The public no longer has the appetite for wars framed around human rights or spreading democracy. And neither does it for prolonged boots in the ground campaigns about Islamic groups. But it still seeks display of strength, an apparent contradiction, but it's nevertheless widely felt and even desired by some in Trump's base. What's different about this new justification or post-neoliberal neocon argument is the partisanship involved that combines many different elements from conspiracy theories to cultural divide politics to create the antagonist. And this new concept isn't reacting to changes in geopolitics as much as forcing those changes by using liberal establishments as the enemy. And this is where anti-globalist rhetoric enters the frame and manifests in messaging as varied as anti-trans rhetoric steeped in really universal human rights concepts, which gets interesting when we talk about universality, but hierarchical concepts, of religion and cultural prejudice in juxtaposition to that, the rejection of multilateralism, conflating that, with communism or other hyperbole that doesn't even make sense, but we'll skip that. Represented in organizations like the United Nations or the European Union. And, I say concept, but it's plural and it's hyperfractured. These are hyperfractured arguments that in many ways mimic social media in scope and speed. It can include contradictions, combative actors, incoherence without losing effectiveness and results in populist framings. Because in this chaos of change, populism serves as an anchor of stability and easy truths. This new age and its portrayal isn't just found in my opinions or, internet comments or artifacts. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth declared, in quotes, "out with idealistic utopianism, in with hard-nosed realism," at the Reagan Defense Forum. Trump's own 2025 national security strategy does not frame U.S. interests in terms of things that we've been hearing really since the Clinton administration: democratic ideals, humanitarianism, universal norms, but instead control over the Western Hemisphere, tying regional stability to U.S. security and access to strategic assets. The document also critiques global institutions and multilateralism as threats to sovereignty, something that's been a continued theme. But in this framework, which is different, narco-terrorism serves two purposes: a geopolitical security rationale as a means to leverage domestic control mechanisms in the homeland and as extensions of regional strategy. So up to now, this has been a combination of existing belief systems redefined or reimagined to continue justification for power and older examples used for legalistic arguments. And that's fine and that's good. I'm sure that someone, if they haven't done so already, has written about the Noriega angle or there's big long legalistic videos on that on YouTube. But as I argued in a Substack piece, Trump's imperialism, which is in Substack, but I would tell you check out the 161 Crew website, because why not? There's a lot of interesting things that you'll see. They put it on their website in Polish, but you can always just use their web browser and translate it back to English. But as I say in that article, Donald Trump is not an anti-imperialist, and that might sound laughable at this point, and it should have always been, but I'm here to tell you it's not. And in that article, I explain why, especially going back to his very, very early beginnings and mixing with third parties and some of his earlier stances on topics. But regardless of that, today, he does not reject empire. And all ideas of Trump being some type of isolationist or peace candidate are gone. He strips it by it, empire, of its liberal euphemisms, right? Empire continues to operate, but it does so without the human rights theater, the humanitarian pretense. And, you know, those are open to the argument and debate about how firm of a statement that can be made, but that's not for now. The idea is that empire doesn't make appeals to universal order. And that this is stunting for some on the left. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, the left gradually replaced, or it isn't replaced, but reoriented itself from transnationalism to a politics more based on negation. Opposition to the U.S. replaced a generative effort for reimagining internationalism or global alternatives for, not for everybody, but for many people. And there's two dynamics at key. One was the neoliberal co-option of humanitarian language, filter through free market capitalism for its globalization project in the 1990s. And the other is the political conditioning that limits our imagination of power to states and actors with recognized leverage. That's really what Trump was talking about. And that leaves popular agency outside the frame. So going back to Chomsky here, and when Chomsky and others criticized what he called post-Cold War new humanism, the core of that critique was that the rhetoric of human rights, humanitarianism, and democracy were in many ways applied selectively, and that the true use of them was to instrumentalize power by Western states. It was to manufacture consent for war in a post-Cold War era where you did not have communism and narco-terrorism wasn't going to be enough, right? So it was invoked to justify intervention. And of course, all of this was in those frameworks being, you know, shown as hypocritical or hypocrisy. And in truth, human rights were enforced unevenly. International law was subordinated to geopolitical interests. The United States was not held to the same standard as other countries. Universalist language of globalization was used to mask that uneven power. The problem in this observation is when misuse gradually over time or critiques turns into rejection of the concepts themselves. So a hyper focus on hypocrisy, right, shifts into a claim, knowingly or not, that universality could itself be wrong because universality is tied to neoliberal globalization. And even the concept that universality is tied to imperialism, a conquest of ideas forced upon people. Now there's a lot there, and there's a lot of counter arguments. What I just said, I think is a faulty premise too, but I'm just going to leave it there so we can get through the narrative. The consequences of this just accepted as described are really profound, because the hypocrisy by neoliberal governments or a systemic result can be viewed as not something to be corrected, but as an indictment on the norms themselves, the claims themselves, universal rights. And this is dangerous for a few reasons. Of course, I'm sure that there are some obvious I probably don't need to state, but one of them being that it just automatically makes international solidarity with people nearly impossible. Solidarity with people is in this depiction recoded or can be recoded as apologetics for Western hegemony. And that's not necessarily new. It's just a mechanism that's changed and maybe to the extent, because many were already predisposed to accept this kind of shift, right? The Cold War trained segments of the Western Western left to legitimize, abstract, theorize away, reflexively, not critically, deny abuses committed by forces positioned against the United States. And, you know, you can, and people will say those are tankies, and that's true, but I think that there's like a sociological aspect. I think there's more to it than just that, right? That perspective came from legitimate experiences within the United States, right? It drew on exposing U.S. propaganda, which existed. And you know, it taught suspicion towards official narratives that was justified. The problem is, for many, this became reflexive, as I stated before, and not critical judgment. And this is where we get into this, you know, the modern use of terms like tanky. And this means information about a foreign atrocity might not be neutrally observed or studied, but dismissed based on the source. And, you know, that's fallacious in and of itself. It's no different than watching, you know, two drunk uncles argue about something that was on Fox News or CNN, saying that because it was on that station, it must be false. But the result of this is people lost privilege to states because stories of people were automatically turned suspect. States were elevated above people in this arrangement, and it didn't need to be in some type of historical materialist, you know, theory. It was just a social conditioning to what was happening on the ground in the United States. And the result was a politics oriented around states rather than people. And in this framework, the Soviet Union came to stand in for internationalism. And for many, that's what it is. But for others, again, not predisposed to theory, this kind of naturally happened. And internationalism became not a practice of cross-border solidarity with people, but a geopolitical counterweight, transitional in form and transnational in form, I should say, and statist in substance of what it is. So, along with, yes, all the influence that maybe some historical materialist theory had on the Western left, and that doesn't, you know, include all of it, but segments of it. There were other sociological and societal things happening that primed people to view the world in this way, regardless. And I think that some on the left focused on concepts, maybe partially due to this, like multipolarity, as opposed to popular uprisings or revolutions from below as an extension of that. And, you know, multipolarity is something that I remember really coming to places and groups that it didn't previously exist in, maybe 10 years ago. You know, it's multipolarity was regulated to people who are in international relations. And of course, you know, there are ideological concepts, but it wasn't something that common folks are talking about on social media, but it became that. And the argument, I suppose, goes that a multipolar world is a necessary alternative to U.S. unipolar dominance. And that U.S. unipolar dominance, which, you know, is post-Cold War, maybe exemplified first in neoliberal globalization, is blamed for war, sanctions, regime changes, economic coercion, loss of sovereignty, empire, hegemony, So multiple power centers could constrain unilateral action and reduce the capacity of any single state to impose its will globally. Sovereignty becomes a defense against intervention, and international norms are viewed skeptically as instruments shaped by Western interests rather than universal principles. But overall, political progress is understood as a more balanced global order. Right? These are some of the arguments. And this will be contested, but the left's embrace of multipolarity unintentionally mimics and has overlap with Trump's foreign policy strategy, not because they share politics, but because they underestimate how a world organized around competing powers actually functions on the ground, outside of maybe international relations, you know, theorizing. And this is where Samir Amin's writings, I think, are useful, because he already wrote about this. I don't need to reinvent the wheel. And he gave warnings about multipolarity, how they play a role in this discussion. He argued that multipolarity on its own is not an emancipatory project. It's just a redistribution of power among states. Right? Without popular struggle and internationalist solidarity from below, the people who I mentioned at the top are going to be the ones left out of these discussions. And the people who I later said are kind of boxed out when politics becomes a politics of geopolitical negation and hegemony. Right. Without popular struggles and international solidarity from below, a multipolar order does not dismantle domination. It just fragments it. And, you know, however many pieces that might be, it might be three large pieces or mosaic, but the decline of a single dominant power can limit what one state is able to do. And so in a world of unipolarity, that might be given primacy, but it does not automatically empower ordinary people. Power does not disappear when a single hegemon weakens. Power redistributes and metastasizes in different ways. And unless those limits on state power are matched by organized social forces capable of holding all centers of power accountable, decisions are going to be concentrated among the same centers that they currently are. In that situation, sovereignty no longer functions as protection, as stated before. It's not a defense, but it's a form of immunity, really, that shields those who rule from challenge. So for people currently engaged in struggle, this doesn't really change much. It reshapes some things and it relocates some things. But in some ways, it can actually give those for whom their struggle is based on more immunity or shield. And in this sense, the convergence with Trump's holding the cards logic is structural rather than ideological. And this is kind of what I said at the top. I wanted to say that first, right? But because I want to get away from individuals and start looking at bigger structures and patterns. Both frameworks, if we're talking about this multipolarity framework, even from a leftist perspective and what Trump is talking about, both frameworks accept a global order in which power from above, not people from below, is the primary political actor, and where legitimacy follows leverage rather than consent. If multipolarity is the answer, but it doesn't inherently liberate anybody, then at the end of the day, withdrawing from universals or universality, what we end up with is power and leverage. And this is what Trump is talking about. The differences are largely rhetorical or theoretically based for arguments maybe more suited to classrooms than material reality. And what Trump states bluntly, parts of the left kind of arrive at indirectly or methodologically, inadvertently, a world where outcomes imposed by force are treated as self-justifying, and where the absence of popular agency is normalized under the guise of geopolitical realism. Amin's critiques cut through this convergence by insisting on what multipolarity alone can't deliver: emancipation without organized struggle and justice without internationalism from below. It's why you're not going to see that in most of these discussions. Now, there's a lot of other reasons why, but they're different. Media, clicks, stuff like that, polarizing. But that internationalism from below is among all of the, what's going to be talked about with Venezuela, Ukraine, or these larger ideas that I'm talking about. That's the real threat. And that's why it's not going to be discussed. So there's also a revealing overlap between left critiques of neoliberal new humanism, as Chomsky put it, and figures like Pete Hegseth, when he dismisses international norms as utopian fantasy. The convergence, again, is not rhetorical or ideological, but there is structural outcomes that converge. But both treat appeals to human rights, let's say, or international law as naive at best and manipulative at worst. And both conclude that politics must be grounded in power rather than constrained by universal principles. Now, what that power is defined differently, because the left will define it as equality, as fractured power, creating like a form of international stasis, I suppose. But again, that's in rhetoric. In reality, this overlap occurs where the left frames this as anti-imperialism, this critique of new humanism, let's say. Hegseth frames it as nationalist realism. Right? The practical result is very similar. I'm not going to say it's the same, but it's similar. Universality is discarded rather than contested. And power is relieved of the obligation to justify itself. Right? It justifies itself by being capable of asserting power. And you know, this is yet another assault, now from multiple angles on universality, and that can be very easily co-opted into an argument against internationalism more broadly, or those people that we were talking about that are left out of this. So the appeal of multipolarity rests on the hope that dispersing power is going to weaken domination, but it can just as easily create plural empire, where multiple power centers exercise coercion within their zones or spheres of influence. And I say that with emphasis because spheres of influence are included in this. So, you know, for example, I'll give a foil. Someone who I focus on a lot, who I think a lot of people dismiss, but for who I think is someone who's a significant figure, even though I disagree with everything he says, and that's Alexander Dugin. Because he can't talk about multipolarity and anti-imperialism without bringing him up, even though, as you do, people immediately roll their eyes and say, well, I don't believe that. Well, okay, but let's actually look at it. So Dugin's multipolarity is not merely a call for several powerless states instead of one, but it's a rejection of universal political standards altogether. And that's extremely important to if we're talking about overlap and convergence, right? In his framework, the world is organized into distinct civilizational spaces, which, okay, the left is going to reject that, but each with its own values, authority structures, and internal logic, none of which can be legitimately judged by external norms. So, you know, rhetoric that the Trump administration increasingly seems to echo, say, about civilizational warnings to Europe, echoing of far-right parties in Europe, of things like replacement theory conspiracies, right? This is where they can sit within a multipolar argument. And what matters now is not so much, because you get into metaphysics and Heidegger and all these things that kind of don't matter for this. Even intent and rhetoric kind of don't matter. But the material political structures are kind of what I want to focus on, because once universality is rejected as in and of itself being imperial, And that's a leap, and not everybody on the left does that. However, it's a risk, and I think some people might, and they might not realize that they're doing it. But when from the left, when the critique of neoliberal globalization goes so far that universality is inherently imperialism itself, politics is no longer about shared standards or transnational solidarity, but about managing relations. And really, those are relations between power blocks and their spheres of influence. And this logic overlaps materially with far-right sovereigntist political parties like Germany's AfD or movements like Casa Pound, who also reject universal norms in favor of national particularity or social protection within borders and insulation of political communities from external judgments with left-wing overtures involved. And in both cases, sovereignty functions as a form of immunity, a justification for excluding scrutiny, dissent, obligation beyond the collective, the tribe, the group, the state, the nation. It's easily transferable to politics of borders, politics of refugees, politics of race, religion, austerity, resentment over failing welfare states. The anti-imperialist left comes at this from a very different angle, but with some shared assumptions, namely that universality is linked to Western power and that political progress consists in constraining that hegemon and that universality is tied to that hegemon. And something else that is surprising is that this type of logic is allowed to operate within Trump's own paradigm. He manages this by because the U.S. dominance is reframed as neoliberal institutional dominance. So U.S. global hegemony from a left-arm perspective is reframed within Trump's world as a neoliberal institutional dominance in global entities like the UN or the EU or more broader populist overtures to elites kind of sit in similar spaces. And that's why the Trump administration has such an antagonistic relationship to Europe. Europe is a symbol. It's a symbolic center of these institutions. And the European Union is a representation of it. And yes, you know, rhetoric and intent are different, but neither redefine the structural similarities in this overlap. And Trump is able to recreate this within his own framework. I think the convergence, it's not accidental. It reflects a deeper philosophical shift in which the critique of universalism slides into the abandonment of the concept of universality itself. Once there's no shared horizon, right, human rights, against which power must explain itself, the question of who rules replaces the question of how power is organized. So multipolarity under these conditions does not limit domination. It just multiplies it. Anti-hegemony or anti-imperialism without internationalism becomes defensive. It doubles down on cynicism. It can become border focused and instinctively suspicious of internationalism as a concept. So both leave the agencies of the people who would be involved in such internationalism involved to the side. And when discussed, well, they can be dismissed. That can be dismissed from a material perspective. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, as liberal moralizing. Or from an anti-imperialist perspective, it can be excused from conversation because it just leads to military intervention, right? Oh, human rights, so you're talking about NATO bombs, things like that. And this is why the transition to populism just across the political spectrum is so smooth, because populism thrives on precisely these conditions, right? Distrust of institutions, rejection of abstract principles, and the conviction that politics is a zero-sum struggle between insiders and outsiders, right? The shift feels intuitive because if we're engaged in extreme cynicism, and that's already been learned, if norms are fake, institutions are rigged, then power and loyalty appear more honest than these abstract principles. And if those concepts are accepted, more or less, then populism becomes structurally syncretic too, because it no longer depends on consistent ideology or shared ethical commitments. It can absorb elements from radically different traditions without friction. Anti-imperialist language merges with nationalist rhetoric and sovereignty. Critiques of neoliberal globalization bleed into civilizational or ethnic narratives. Left skepticism toward humanitarianism overlaps with right-wing rejection of universal human rights. Once universality is treated as a fraud, any narrative that promises protection against it can be combined with any other component. Makes it very difficult to critique because it's almost just mix and match. And in this sense, populism is not a break from post-Cold War anti-hegemonic critique, but one of its unintended destinations. When internationalism from below is replaced, and that's a strong word, I don't mean it to say it's fully replaced, but just for the argument that when it's supplanted partially by the concept of negation to hegemony, and when politics is reduced to blocking a hegemon rather than building shared obligations or alternatives from below, the ground is cleared for a politics that can move seamlessly across left and right. Realism and resentment, critique and domination. And what makes this especially important is that it not only benefits the United States, and it does. It does arguably benefit the U.S., and here's why. If there were some type of multipolar reality, instead of a perceived decline in empire that has existed, which has been partially based in overextension of the empire, it can be retooled to maintain power while relinquishing those global obligations. So this can benefit the United States strategically, but it also benefits Russia and it also benefits China, right? The losers are Europe. And not just Europe, the continent or countries, the Hague, the United Nations, the European Union. What happens in Ukraine becomes a regional matter, just as Russia explained it in the outset. What could potentially happen in Taiwan becomes an internal matter. What happens in Venezuela could potentially become hemispheric or an internal state of affairs. Once everything is internal to someone's zone, sphere of influence, nothing is fully contestable anymore to universal laws, regardless of how unevenly they were applied in the past. And, you know, if this all sounds pretty bad, right? We have this convergence that's happening, and I think people are left with, okay, that's horrible, okay, but now what? And I think really there's two chunks of this, and that's the biggest 80% of the chunk, is just wrapping minds around all of that and contesting it and testing it and finding what's true and what's not true, because these are just observations I've had in the past day and a half or so. But, you know, I can say this, and I felt like I needed to add this. It isn't as if these are conclusive, and it isn't as if this is the end. It's a description of events, and there are other perspectives aside from caveats and things that existed previously. But I think the alternative perspective for now would reject the idea that politics is exhausted by competition between powerful states or blocs, right? We don't need to accept that. I think that alternative perspectives would hold that power might determine outcomes, but it does not define what counts as politics, right? Treating geopolitics as the only arena of action is capitulating to political realism, but it's not realism even. It's a decision to stop recognizing people without leverage as meaningful political actors. It's a choice to do that, right? It's not something that is somehow defined or mathematically concluded. It's a choice that's being made, and that choice doesn't have to be made. So from this view, the failure of neoliberal humanitarianism doesn't necessarily discredit internationalism or concepts of universality that need to exist below that. It shows how universal principles were misused and misunderstood from above, right? Or filtered differently. The response is not to abandon norms or accountability, but to contest them and rebuild them from below. Universality is not something that states grant or institutions own. It's something that people assert against power, including against states that claim to represent them. And this is foundational to many leftist principles. Applied to Venezuela, this means rejecting the false choice between Maduro or Washington, right? All of these binaries that we don't need to engage with, sovereignty or intervention, unipolarity or multipolarity. Venezuelan politics does not disappear because elites impose outcomes. Independent unions, protest movements, community organizations, labor struggles remain politically meaningful even when they're repressed or defeated. And this counts pre-US intervention too. Their exclusion from political settlements that might be happening in the future is not proof that they're irrelevant. It's actually evidence that popular agency is treated as a threat itself, which is why I said earlier that yes, there are reasons why these voices are left out, but one of those reasons is because it is a true threat, and that we don't need to speak in the language of those who view it as a threat. So we can also reject sovereignty as immunity, right? Without somehow default embracing imperialism. Sovereignty has political value only if it enables people to exercise control over their lives. That's not some universal imperialist principle. When it shields elites from scrutiny or justifies repression as defense in some type of geopolitical hegemonic discussion, it ceases to be emancipatory. And representatives become illegitimate at that point. Against the idea that norms are inherently imperial and populism is an honest response somehow, This view insists that cynicism is learned. It's not inevitable. It's not something that we need to just accept. Treating all universal claims as fraud prepares the ground for politics where power justifies itself by strength alone. The alternative is not utopian unless you're on Hegseth's camp. Right? It's a refusal to accept that politics belongs only to those who, quote unquote, hold the cards. Politics begins with people asserting claims on power, even when those claims are denied. So what we're really watching is not just a shift in who holds power, but a shift in what power is expected to answer to. Across Venezuela, Ukraine, Syria, and beyond, politics is increasingly defined by leverage rather than consent, and by outcomes imposed from above rather than agency asserted from below. Trump's blunt claim that some leaders hold the cards, he didn't invent this logic, but he did put it on full display, perhaps inadvertently. What's more unsettling is how easily that same logic now appears across the political spectrum. On the right, it's framed as leadership through strength, possibly. On the parts of the left, it can reappear through multipolarity and anti-hegemonic critique. Different rhetoric and intent, for sure, but similar structure. States matter, power decides, and people are secondary, if not suspect in and of themselves. But this isn't the end of the story, right? The failure of neoliberal humanitarianism, globalization doesn't mean that universality itself was a lie, nor that leftist internationalism should be conflated with it. Internationalism based on shared principles of struggle has always been a base for global solidarity, not owned by neoliberal globalization or or rejected, negated by right-wing nationalist depictions of globalists. The real alternative, and this is my humble opinion, in the discussions that we're having, isn't choosing between Washington or Caracas, unipolarity or multipolarity, intervention or abandonment. It's refusing a politics that begins and ends with who holds the cards. Politics doesn't disappear because power ignores people. It begins wherever people insist that power answers to them, even when those demands are denied, suppressed, or erased. So that's the line to hold on to. And those are some of the things and considerations I think we should be focusing on while discussing what's happening in Venezuela and other events in the world.